Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. In the aftermath of the violent white supremacist gathering in Charlottesville, Virginia, there's been a backlash against Confederate icons in various places across the country, as well as a whimper of Confederate resurgence advocates. Confederate statues in a number of cities have been removed or covered pending removal. A planned white supremacist rally in Boston drew only a handful of participants, who were surrounded by tens of thousands of anti-racist protesters. There were no reported incidents of violence at that protest, but dozens of white supremacists' gatherings in cities across the country that had been planned for this weekend were canceled. Meanwhile, in Westerville, Ohio, on the outskirts of Columbus, several residents awoke to find the word Jew scrawled across their driveways and written in shaving cream, and Nazi literature was distributed to about 30 addresses in that vicinity. In Columbus, a Civil War memorial and a cemetery was vandalized anonymously, and though my sense of the discussion among activists here seems to have been a general agreement that cemeteries should be left unmolested, and that this particular statue was not a Confederate memorial per se, but rather a testament to Confederate prisoners of war who were incarcerated at Camp Chase in Columbus and who died of various infectious diseases. My own feeling is that damaging that particular memorial did more to harm the cause of anti-racism than to help it, which leads me to wonder, in fact, if it was anti-racists who did the damage in the first place, or maybe people allied with white supremacists seeking to make anti-racists look bad. Of course, as evidenced by the non-group of loosely affiliated individuals calling themselves Antifa, it's clear that there are elements within the majoritarian anti-racist movement who aren't particularly concerned with appearances. But when media outlets focus on the antics of Antifa to the expense of giving a fuller articulation to principled analytical messages from the broader anti-racist coalition, they become, in a sense, complicit in obscuring the deeper issues of systemic racism and the root causes of bigotry. So it is as well with the matter of another white supremacist edifice, the statue of Christopher Columbus, shadowing our city hall in downtown Columbus. It was the scene of another protest over the weekend as demonstrators called for the removal of the statue. We have audio from that gathering thanks to videographer Steve Farber, so we'll hear their reasoning and in their own words in a bit. The demonstration drew inarticulate ire from the usual smattering of internet trolls and dispatch respondents, many dismissing demonstrators with a single epithet, and others with fragmentary arguments claiming that the removal of statues is an attempt to erase history. It's interesting that those same people are conspicuously silent about the banning of the Chicano Studies program in Arizona public schools a few years ago. That, by the way, was just overturned by a federal judge this week. What they overlook or can't comprehend or otherwise refuse to acknowledge is that a statue of a man, Columbus, who was a mass murderer and a thief who tortured and raped and plundered and kickstarted the Atlantic slave trade, standing on the lawn of the city administration building with no mention of his epic historic crimes, sends a message that obscures the real history of the man and the events associated with him. It serves to perpetuate a false narrative, sometimes called the Discovery Doctrine, which paints Columbus as an intrepid navigator bent on proving an unpopular theory about the roundness of the earth and who, upon arrival in the Americas, which he mistakenly believed was India, he was attacked by hostile natives who he then heroically subdued and forced into contractual submission. We know that this is a lie. Columbus was a terrible navigator and a brutal tyrant, mistreating his own crew, according to their writings. That the earth was round was hardly an obscure theory at the time of Columbus's fabled voyage, and what he was really after was gold and territory, not even for Italy, but for the Queen of Spain who commissioned him. That some Italians like to claim Columbus as a shining example of Italian heritage is really kind of mystifying. Amerigo Vespucci was a far better navigator and a true explorer whose mission had more to do with cartography than with conquest. Some point out that Thomas Jefferson and George Washington were also slaveholders. Washington even relentlessly pursued one of his slaves who escaped right up until his death. Monuments to these men and others like them abound, and while it may indeed be hypocritical to commemorate them for their accomplishments while whitewashing their misdeeds, Columbus is a special case because the man has no positives in his legacy whatsoever. Jefferson was a visionary statesman for his time who laid the foundations of our constitutional democracy. Washington was a military strategist who led the European colonists to victory in the Revolutionary War. But Columbus was nothing but a murderous mercenary. Therefore, there is no hypocrisy in commemorating him. There is only travesty. And, speaking of travesty, it's common knowledge that things in Venezuela have gone from bad to worse as pro-business opposition groups in Venezuela, in part financed by the United States, have driven the government of Nicolas Maduro to overreach its authority and as the two sides vie for control. The Venezuelan economy, already weakened by the global drop in oil prices and perhaps by short-sighted financial management under the previous administration, has become desperate, a condition which politically tends to favor the opposition. But here in the U.S., we seem to only hear about or from the opposition. We never hear about or from anyone who remains supportive of Maduro and the Venezuelan Revolution. Comb through the archives of any of the major networks and interviews with or even quotes from anyone in the Maduro administration or any of the citizen activists or community or organization leaders who are not allied with the opposition are scarce to be found. We're led to believe that Maduro is a ruthless, unpopular dictator bent on consolidating power, and that the opposition is an organic uprising of citizens wanting a restoration of democracy. Starting with the fact that Maduro was duly elected in a regular election that international observers certified as fair and open, evidence suggests at least a more nuanced reality than the one the American commercial and so-called public media are presenting. So in today's show, we have an interview segment from the Real News Network featuring journalist Abby Martin, who has spent a considerable time recently in Venezuela interviewing both government officials and opposition leaders alike. We'll start with audio from the demonstration at the Statue of Columbus over the weekend.
Since the death of Henry. Cameron Green! Mike Brown! In the name of others! And so the People's Justice Project has stayed on the front line and faced racism and hate on every stand. These statues, and I've been on Facebook for the last 24 hours, people wonder why we're talking about statues in my community and outside of it. And these statues are symbols that exist to divide us.
Yeah.
And I don't know what this city will decide about Greece for Columbus, but there's a whole lot of statues that exist to divide us. But it's not really about the statue. Yeah. It's about the system. That's built on the oppression of black and brown bodies. And so we'll shift to the immigrant. Ruben and I had this conversation this morning. We'll shift to the immigrant band. And there's a statue movement. And I still see some signs that say Black Lives Matter. And while we're shifting, they are deciding that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist group.
Right.
Hell no.
And so what we must do is go in there, not on Saturday, but on Monday,
right,
and demand that they represent my people.
Yeah.
And that I don't have to let it be it. I don't have to question when I fuck my partner cries, does a man getting out of his car next to me hate me because of the color of my skin?
That's right.
And that's the fear we live in as black people. I don't get to take my skin off. But the same people that marched in Charlottesville walked back into society on Monday.
And they're from Ohio.
Many from Ohio. That we pass by every day. And so this fight to me is that we have to go have a conversation, my allies, with our cousins, with our uncles, and our friends. Because I shouldn't have to live in fear for my life as an American.
Yeah.
My great-great-grandfather, John Nesbitt, was a slave who escaped slavery and walked from near Nashville, Tennessee to Kentucky to join the U.S. Colored Troops and to fight in the 4th Regiment for this country. And so for those of you that don't know, don't be the fight for freedom stays in me. Because my people are not free still in this country.
That's right.
Their bodies are a sacrifice every day. Last week alone, my community buried 5-6 people. Yesterday, a young man stood in my office with someone being shot. Our bodies stay on the line, and now our bodies are on the line in this fight. The sacrifice is too much. And I need you. I need each and every one of you in this fight. And it's not just about me as a black person. It's about my brown brothers and sisters. Ruben don't get to take his skin off.
Right.
Or his heritage, or his people's struggle. So we gotta figure out together. Yes, we need to acknowledge that people's bodies built this country. That there was somebody here before Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And that slavery produced Jim Crow. Produce segregation, produce mass incarceration,
that's right.
And we still fight. And right now people are marching on Washington, because if you think slavery is over, I hope you saw the 13th Amendment. Okay, so let's abolish slavery. We need a constitutional amendment, because brothers and sisters right now are locked up, treated as slaves. And so I thank you for your time. I thank you for your commitment to justice. But I'm gonna beg you to build a movement that exists and sustains itself for black lives.
Woo!
Hallelujah! My name is Alyssa Washuta. I am an enrolled member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, whose homeland is located in what is now Washington State. And that was my state of residence until just a few weeks ago. I'm also a descendant of Chief Tonneth of the Cascade people of the Columbia River. Chihuana is what we call it.
Yes.
In 1856, the U.S. government hanged Tonneth, my great-great-great-grandfather, for treason, a crime he did not commit. Although I come from a family that has been resisting colonization for a long time, I can only speak for myself today. I'd only been living in this city for a couple of weeks when, after last weekend's march to the State House, I was surprised to find myself looking at a familiar figure, the statue of Christopher Columbus that's on the State House grounds. Cristobal Colon, the man we know as Christopher Columbus, was an agent of and continues to be a symbol of the genocide of the indigenous peoples of the Americas.
Yes.
Now I know of two other monuments to this man in our city. This one I'm standing in front of right now, and another at Columbus State Community College.
Yes.
Christopher Columbus and the so-called explorers he showed up with enslaved massive numbers of Taino people. They stole their land, they denied them their traditional means of food gathering. They sent some enslaved Taino people to Europe to be sold, and many died along the way. The colonizers raped and murdered. They brought war dogs for the purpose of hunting and attacking indigenous people. The historical record is full of accounts of the brutality of Colon and his men, written by observers and participants. In a particularly descriptive account of this violence, Bartolomé de las Casas, who was a missionary who accompanied Colon and his troops, said, a quote, "It was a general rule among the Spaniards to be cruel, not just cruel but extraordinarily cruel, so that harsh and bitter treatment would prevent Indians from daring to think of themselves as human beings or having a minute to think at all. So they would cut an Indian's hands and leave them dangling by a shred of skin and would send them on saying, 'Go now, spread the news to your chiefs.' They would test their swords and their manly strength on captured Indians and place bets on the slicing off of heads or the cutting of bodies in half with one blow." End quote.
That ain't right. That ain't right.
Within 10 years of Christopher Columbus's arrival to the island he called Española, millions of people there had been murdered, tortured, enslaved, and culturally robbed. This is colonization.
Right.
This was not discovery.
Right.
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 This was death. This was irreversible loss. This is what our city celebrates by maintaining this statue in public view.
Yeah.
A statue is a public remembrance. But to celebrate Christopher Columbus as a hero, as the man who symbolized the spirit of the frontier, as the State House statue's base says, this is to misremember him. The indigenous peoples who lived across this land were doing well before the colonizers arrived. The Shawnee, Miami, Delaware, Ottawa, and Wyandotte people existed long before the state of Ohio was even a glimmer in the eyes of the leaders of the settlers. And this settler nation would force those native nations from this homeland. Christopher Columbus did not discover our peoples. He was not the admiral of the ocean sea. He was an instigator of hundreds of interconnected apocalypses.
Yes.
The genocides of peoples who have always known these lands better than settlers ever will. We emerged from the earth and the water and the sky here. I plan to make a life in this city. And as a Cowlitz and Cascade woman, I understand the message these statues send. They send the message that Native death is to be celebrated and that I do not belong here. But I don't believe that. I believe I come from the earth and water of the river we call Inchiwana, thousands of miles from here, but still sharing the same island. Native people belong here, and the city should remove this statue from public view as an acknowledgement of that truth.
Yeah.
The replica of the Santa Maria that used to float on the river is now stored in pieces around the city, I hear. It's no longer in public view because of its condition. Let these statues join it.
Right.
Yeah.
These tributes to a murderer communicate a celebration of victory over the first peoples of this land. People who were never really conquered and who walk among the settlers who sought to destroy us. Shawnee poet Laura Day writes, "Where is this ground unstained with blood? I say, remove this glorification of the bloodletting, and let that act only be the beginning of an end to oppression on this stolen land." Thank you for coming. Toshikakwa.
After each speaker, then we're going to have a moment of silence, and I'm going to ask our friend Anna to come here. And I know she's been around, but I want us to honor life in its fullest, the wind, the water, the sky, and the earth, because the sacredness of all of that, specifically of water, no, is what we're talking about. And to have something like this dishonor that in the form of people, of our people, that is the continual genocide of who we are. So let's have a moment of silence. Thank you. Muchas gracias. So the last scheduled speaker, I'm pleased and I'm really happy that she's with us. And I'm just going to let her speak for herself. And my friend Jasmine Ayers, she's got her T-shirt on as I do.
Hello, everybody. I've started a thing where I begin my addresses by telling everybody that I love them, and that I'm glad that you're here, and I'm thankful that you're here. So I love you, everybody. Thank you for being here. I was born and raised on the north side of Columbus. I have lost track of the people that I went to high school with that are dead or in jail. And so state-sanctioned violence doesn't just look like police. State-sanctioned violence looks like poverty. Poverty is violent. When people cannot feed their families, what do? They turn to crime. And so we need to think about state-sanctioned violence, not just the police assaulting us, which they do, but also how our city officials are determining where funds go and into what communities.
Right.
You are making a violent statement when you pick one community to invest in over another.
That's right.
And I am also so tired of marching. I'm tired of being afraid. I'm tired of worrying about the black men that I love,
yeah,
if they're gonna come home or not.
Right.
And that starts by changing what's inside.
That's right.
And that's why I'm running for city council.
Yeah.
The city of Columbus has had a budget surplus for the past several years. We have had millions of dollars left over. Millions of dollars left over. So when they tell us they can't put this education program in this neighborhood, they can't pave these sidewalks, or they can't put these streetlights up, they are lying.
Right.
There are plenty of resources in this city to go around, but they are picking and choosing who deserves to win and who does not. Yes. So I'm not gonna stay long. It's hot. Please, please get involved when you leave this space. We are canvassing tomorrow at 372 Morrison Avenue on the east side. We're gonna get out on the east side from 1 to 4. Come check us out. We're also having a rally thing where Miss Hood is one of our featured speakers. Nina Turner and Sean King are also coming in. Yeah. So September 2nd at 7 p.m., see this man right here for more information. Myself and other Yes We Can candidates will be there as well. Again, I love you. I appreciate you. Get involved. Get educated. All power to the people.
Yeah. All power
to the people.
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 I just want to mention real quick that there's other Yes We Can candidates, and I'm doing this unabashedly because this is where we have to start. There's lots of conversation about voting or not, but this is one way to affect change.
Right.
I truly believe that. We have Jasmine, of course, Will Petrick running for city council, but also Aaron Upchurch, Amy Harkins, and Abby Vale running for school board. Vote for them. Look them up, all right? Look up the Yes We Can Facebook page, website, and please support. Do what you can. Give. Go to the streets with them and what have you. We need your support. We need to win. So let's a moment of silence for the leaders that are attempting change through running for office and working on the sidelines, making that possible for us.
Join the movement. Continue to resist the oppressive systems that keep choose to divide us as people. You can like People's Justice Project on Facebook. We list our organizing, our movement there. But it's not about our movement alone. It's about all of these movements that are represented here, and there are many of movement leaders here. Join the movement where you can do your best work. I tell people all the time, and I think it's best to end this way, look at the person next to you and tell them their presence. Repeat after me, your presence,
your presence
is required, on the front line, of justice. Say it again like you mean it. Your presence
is required,
on the front line, of justice.
Thank you.
White people, we have to do more.
Yes.
We have to give more.
Yes.
We have to show up more.
Yes.
Go home and talk to your friends, talk to your families, bring this up in your workplace. This does not end until we end it.
Yeah.
All right. My name is Ruben. I'm with the Central High Workers Center. We work on worker justice and immigrant justice. Look us up on our Facebook page or our website. If you want to work specifically on sanctuary, on worker rights, we'd be happy to have you with us. All right, so I want to end this kind of the way that we started, and we came peacefully, no?
Yeah.
We gathered peacefully, non-violently, no?
Yeah.
And we did it with love, I think.
Yeah.
Right. And we did it in the midst of the elements, of the true elements of this earth, of this world. Underneath this ugly concrete, human-made, human-poured, by workers, mind you, right? Is the earth, is the dirt that we honor. So we lift up the earth and the work that we do. And to our right, there's actually water there, right? And so we honor the sacredness of water.
and not necessarily because we've made a beautiful greenery and banks and all this stuff around it. We appreciate that, but we must continue to honor the water. Yeah, but, and that's big, no? And above us, whether it's the sky or the clouds, the blue sky today, that's kind of nice in Columbus. Yes. Or whether it be cloudy and humid, or rainy, or snow, is the elements of the environment, right? And the wind, as it has kept us fresh and somewhat cool today, that somehow must empower us to continue coming together, being together, moving stuff, confronting radically, sin miedo, without fear. Sometimes, and I heard that we were fearful. I'm becoming more fearful in this country. It is the way it is today. But I'm not scared.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I am not scared because we have each other's backs.
Yes.
And so we have to continue. But remember what we said to do, right? You have to show up. We have to march. We have to work inside the system. We need people in there. You have to work outside the system. If you're a person of faith, pray. That's great. We need prayer and action, right?
Right.
And so working outside the system, but also the power of working against the system.
Yeah.
Right? Because we know systematically what this person represents. It's no coincidence that it's in front of our city hall in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
It's no coincidence that it also stands at the state house in the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
And it's no coincidence that it stands prominently, probably most prominently, in front of a major educational system in our city. How many countries did you say?
130,
right? And there it stands in its whiteness, if you will, pointing to us. So we have to gather, we have to work within the system, outside the system, against the system, and connect with people who that's their specialty, right? And we can't do them all. The change won't happen with just any of them by themselves, right? We have to dismantle the system, but we have to create another one.
Right.
Yeah.
You cannot. And this is not mine. This comes from Angela Davis. She says it makes little sense to dismantle without creating.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense to create without dismantling.
Yeah.
It has to be both. And that's why we're here together. Thank you so much for being with us, for your time. Is there anything else anybody wants to say before closing the organizers? No. Tynan, are we good? Thank you so much. Muchas gracias. Peace be with you. Peace be with you. But show up. All right? Thank you. Gracias.
Peace and prayer.
That was one of the voices of the folks who gathered over the weekend to call for the removal of the statue of Christopher Columbus. The removal of statues and monuments such as this eliminates a small symbol of hypocrisy and creates a teachable moment. It does not eliminate racism or erase atrocities of the past, but it makes it just a little easier to prevent them from being repeated. We turn next to a piece about Venezuela, featuring an interview with journalist Abby Martin.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Pires coming to you from Baltimore. Violent protests between opposition demonstrators and police forces in Venezuela have been going on for over 2 months now, with an average of almost one dead per day. Most of the international press portrays the death as being the result of police state repression. However, a detailed breakdown from the Attorney General's office, which has recently been increasingly at odds with the government of President Maduro, shows that of the 73 people that died, 11 were the responsibility of state security forces. 21 of them has been attributed to the opposition, 13 due to looting and 2 due to government civilian protests, and 26 are still under investigation. One of the victims of the protests was Orlando Figueira, who was burned alive last month when opposition demonstrators accused him of being a thief or a Chavista. He died from his wounds last Monday. This is what his mother had to say.
Si es así, ¿por qué Julio Borges lo permite y Enrique Capriles lo permiten? Entonces, ¿a quién yo voy a culpar? A la oposición, al vandalismo de ellos, porque ellos fueron los que le echaron gasolina a mi hijo, como un animal. ¿A quién más voy a culpar yo?
Obviously, his mother considers this the responsibility of the leadership of the opposition. Joining us to discuss the latest developments in Venezuela is Abby Martin. Abby is the host of the Telesu English documentary program, Empire Files, that Abby and Mike Prinzer independently produce. And they recently returned from a trip to Venezuela, and they were caught up in the midst of opposition demonstrations. Thank you for joining me, Abby.
Thanks so much, Sharmini. It's great to be on.
So, Abby, you went to Venezuela I spoke to you before you left, and you were going there on an inquiry to figure out what was going on. You found yourself in the midst of opposition demonstrations. Describe how you got there, why you were there, and what happened.
Sure. My partner, Mike Preisner, and I wanted to go to Venezuela, of course, with a country that's been in the crosshairs of the U.S. empire for the last decade plus, obviously, since the Bolivarian Revolution. It's even been deemed the greatest threat to the Western Hemisphere, of course, amidst all of these threats. And of course, regime change calls from Trump himself, and of course, this bill from Mark Rubio offering to give $10 million to the opposition, which would turn into exponentially more on the black market there. Of course, we wanted to go and check out what was going on. We actually had planned the trip before all the unrest popped off, so we were kind of scared. I had seen all this footage of the crackdowns, what I thought was really harsh repression based on the footage and news that I was seeing from here. So I was going with a completely open mind. I was going there as an independent, fiercely independent investigative journalist with the show, as you said, produced completely independently from Telesur, to tell exactly the reality that I was seeing. And I even told Telesur management that I was going to report exactly what the truth was that I uncovered. So when we went there, I was very surprised to see that the reality was vastly different than what we are being told, Sharmini. I mean, yes, you hear all these horrific stories, right, from on the ground amidst these protests. You keep hearing 60 dead. Maduro kills 60 protesters, Maduro's forces. And what you realize when you get there is the country is pretty much split in two. It's heavily divided between Chavistas and the opposition, and of course, amidst such a horrible economic crisis, people are going to have really strong opinions. But there are certainly huge marches on the ground on both sides. Tens of thousands of people marching for the government, for the opposition, and these are peaceful marches. A jubilant atmosphere. Things are very calm, and then what you realize is when you see these violent statistics and casualties and the death toll that's rising and the harsh quote-unquote repression from government forces, it's not happening at these marches. It's happening at something called guarimbas. It's a sustained blockade that a small contingent of protesters create to provoke a response from government officials. So we actually followed one of these guarimbas one night. We were almost attacked just simply for being there. We got accosted by a hyped up group of protesters who were saying, who are you with? Who are you with? Demanding to see our press credentials. And I was scared for my life, knowing that if we admitted that we were from Telesur, we could have gotten lynched, burned alive, beaten to death by the mobs that you see happening all too often. So we, of course, said that we were independent journalists, that we were from America. And then they immediately said, okay, great, we can use you essentially for propaganda. They said, do not film anything we do. Just film what the government does to us, Charmini. So we saw that night what these people do on the quote-unquote front lines of these protests. I mean, they pulled out giant 16-wheeler trucks. They pulled people out of the trucks, moved the trucks onto the highway to block entrances and exits. They were pulling huge piles of trash and burning them, pouring gasoline on the front entrances and exits of these highway overpasses and erupting in flames. And so trucks were and cars were trying to frantically get out of the way. And this is how a lot of people have died. This death toll that you see being kind of parroted, regurgitated mindlessly by MSM does not account for the actual breakdown that you mentioned in the intro, which is the vast majority has been caused by either indirect or direct violence by the opposition.
In what form did you see these threats launch against you about lynching, about attacking you? Is that a Twitter attacks, or did you actually hear it on the ground?
Well, yeah, good question, Sharmini. This has been translated actually into real life actions now. It started off on Twitter, and a lot of people can say, "Oh, just turn off your Twitter." It's not as easy as that. When you have hundreds of death threats coming in, you have to take it seriously, especially when these people do act on it there. And there are Telesur journalists risking their lives to still be on the ground at these protests and now have a target on their back. It started off on Twitter, of course, Instagram, Facebook, which are all manageable until it translates into real life. And this one woman, Angie Perez, a quote-unquote Emmy Award-winning journalist from Miami, was tweeting out coordinates where Mike was going to be speaking in L.A. when we got back. And about 20 right-wing, anti-communists came out with giant signs saying that Mike and I were spies for the dictatorship and narco-traffickers. And so you see this actually being translated into real life, where now we're getting harassed in person by the same people who are inciting people to lynch us. So we have to have security now. I'm contemplating legal action against this woman, at least in the U.S., who's doing this. I mean, it's just completely insane that these people can perpetuate such an audaciously fake myth, knowing that our lives are on the line and that other journalists' lives are on the line, instead of actually just denouncing the violence, which would be a lot easier.
Abby, one thing I've noticed when it comes to Venezuela is that all of these international watchdogs, like Human Rights Watch, the Organization of American States, particularly their Committee on Human Rights and Freedom of Expression and so on, as well as so many other mainstream organizations, that if this was happening anywhere in the world, they would be on it. And when it comes to Venezuela, very little is reported from these organizations. I'm wondering what your thoughts are and what's not getting reported here.
Yeah, and to give some context to this, I mean, to really explain the violence that the opposition is carrying out and the complete absence of commentary on this violence from these watchdogs, Sharmini. I mean, we're talking about these protesters that have attacked hospitals, burned down government buildings. They burned down the housing ministry, which has provided 1.6 million homes for poor people over the last decade. Political assassinations, I mean, directly assassinating Chavistas, attacking communes. We visited one building that was, all the windows were broken. It was simply an art commune that gave out free dance lessons and music lessons to local kids. I mean, it's kind of sick when you see on the front lines what is being attacked. And why? What is the political motivation behind these lynch mobs? Before I get into the story that happened to us and what's going on to journalists, I mean, you mentioned that young man, Orlando Figuera, that was burned alive. This is the third Afro-Venezuelan who has been lynched, attacked by a mob during these protests, black. And you know, the clip with his family being interviewed, and even him before he tragically died from his severe burns, he said that they said, "Hey, black guy, are you a Chavista?" And they threw a Molotov cocktail on him. I mean, they have pulled bus drivers out of the buses and torched the buses. They throwing explosives at people. So, you know, it is just quite astounding. Not only is that happening, but then when you look at what happens to journalists there, before we went, of course, we heard, you know, even Reuters journalists had been attacked by these people. But we know how dangerous it is to be a state-run journalist there, Sharmini, which is why we didn't say that we were openly with Telesur. But we didn't know how bad it was until after we were there on the ground reporting. Because once the photos came out that we were there and started circulating and tying us back to Telesur, then things got really, really bad. a complete fake propaganda campaign. We basically became the center of a fake news viral campaign in Venezuela, started and fomented by major opposition leaders in the media, major academics there, that were propagating the theory that Mike and I were actually spies infiltrating the protests to collect intelligence for the GNB, the Venezuelan intelligence services, based on absolutely nothing, based on me doing my job as a journalist, going there and actually trying to get the truth, to cover all sides. I mean, I put my life on the line. We all put our lives on the line to get the story from these people, creating these barricades in the peaceful marches, on all sides, average Venezuelans on the streets. So it was so shocking and disheartening to see this campaign being subjected against us simply because we brought up opposition violence. You know, here we are looking at a country that kind of opines about how all the press is controlled by the state, how the government has a lockdown on all press, how you can't be safe as a journalist reporting on the street, that there's a total police state there. It was the complete opposite. I mean, I had no problems filming anything. The clear assault on the press is from the opposition, who doesn't want you to report the truth. I mean, if they put up free press as this beacon, but they don't want you to report anything that contradicts their narrative, even when it's completely proven by the attorney general herself, who was even at odds with Maduro, as you mentioned. So, you know, when we dared to bring up the fact that the opposition was responsible for half the deaths, because half the story has been omitted by the Western media and these human rights watch organizations, we became subjected to a lynch mob. Not only was this fake news perpetrated around about us, but it incited hundreds of death threats, actual lynch threats. I've never been subjected to actual lynch threats before. And it was just all the same thing. Lynch them, burn them, throw Molotov cocktails on them. We know what to do to infiltrators. Do to them what we've done to the other infiltrators, saying like burn them alive. I mean, basically, if we were still there, Sharmini, we would have a target on our back. And we've seen that play out in the wake of us leaving, where a Telesur journalist actually just got attacked with Molotov cocktails, nails, and shot in the back by opposition protesters when she was clearly marked press and standing with cameramen. This is not the first time journalists have been attacked. Someone else from Global Vision was doused with gasoline and luckily escaped before they were burned alive. If this was happening to journalists in any other part of the world, there would be a huge outcry from international watchdogs. But unfortunately, because it's Venezuela and because the U.S. empire wants regime change there, this is completely obfuscated. And in fact, these people are painted as peaceful, democracy-loving freedom fighters. And it makes me sick because I see the same thing played out in Ukraine, Syria, time and again. And I was there. We risked our lives and we're getting a lynch mob incited against us. And there's not a peep from these people. Instead, you see Ken Roth from Human Rights Watch actually calling for a violent coup and has the audacity to just completely marginalize the real situation, Sharmini.
All right, Abby, I know you just got back and you're still recovering from that experience. I thank you so much for joining us just after your return. And as the situation unfolds and you are able to reflect on what happened, we would love to have you back to continue to report this very important story.
Thanks so much, Sharmini. Real News is definitely the best place to get your news on the front lines of this story. Thanks for your coverage.
And thank you for joining us here on the Real News Network.
That was Abby Martin, formerly of RT News, being interviewed on the Real News Network. Lastly, we have a speech by actor and activist Danny Glover, who has traveled to Venezuela on numerous occasions and who has been an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy and of the media's treatment of the situation there. This is from a rally in Los Angeles about a year ago.
The natural reason is to remain with the people, and that's real democracy.
Because our government is currently funding the right wing in Venezuela to create a larger sphere of influence and to really create their own outcome.
I'm encouraged that all of you out here in support of a process of democracy and a reimagining of democracy that's been taking place in Venezuela. The people have spoken The speaker have spoken election after election, more than 20 elections. More than 20 elections, reaffirming their commitment to the Bolivarian Revolution. As we stand here today in opposition to what our government has done in order to provide misinformation with the help of CNN, with the unique, with the specific help of CNN, we stand here in defense of the electoral process that's going on in Venezuela. Electoral process that President Jimmy Carter says is the best in the world has continued. I've been a part of that. I've watched that. I've gone to polling stations year after year, elections and elections, and I've seen the process, the accountability, the responsibility, not only of governance and making sure that people are accounted for and allowed to express their interests, but also the fact that they are there realizing that, that they see that their engagement means something. And what has it meant?
Democracy.
What has it meant into the last democracy that over by the end of this year, the party, the government has built more than 1 million houses. By the end of this year, by the middle of next year, they will build them 500,000 more houses. It also means that the extreme poverty is now 5% down from 21% in 1999. Five poverty. These are the things that have happened. What we have here is the form of regime change. So you cannot find and you cannot dispute the fact that this is a fair election. The elections have always been fair. But you can, in some sense, you cannot overwhelm and over, you do all the mechanisms you use to overturn this government have not worked. So what do you have to do? You have to disqualify the election. We saw that in 2013, we saw that. If it had not been for Brazil and the rest of the world says, no, we're not gonna put up with that. We know that these elections are found. You're gonna have to validate this election right here. And they validated this election. Only with their validation did the American, did the US and those who've been in opposition to the Bolivarian Revolution came on board. So we have to stand out here.
Yes.
I've been able to at every moment watch the evolution of this process. Barlovento, a community of Afro-descended communities who benefited from the Bolivarian Revolution, who set up cooperatives in Barlovento, who set up different other relationships in Barlovento. Remember, this is an attack on the Venezuelan people, first of all. It's an attack on Venezuelan people, but it's an attack on the ideas that come out of the Bolivarian Revolution. The ideas such as Petrocaribe. You ask those countries, Caribbean countries, who benefited from Petrocaribe, what the Bolivarian Revolution has meant. You often ask some different relationships. It was Maduro, President Maduro, who was very, very instrumental in bringing the FARC and the Colombian government together. We don't think we remember that. It was him. And there's a negotiation process that's going on now. And why is that as important? Because in Colombia, out of the 4 million internally displaced citizens, 2 million of those are African descendants. So those are the realities here. What realities, you cannot turn back to the clock of time. And that's what this country is trying to do, is turn back the clock of time. You cannot turn back it. The forces that brought together this process, the Bolivarian Revolution, that swept Latin America from Bolivia to Ecuador to do, those forces in motion, those forces are real forces, they're people forces. And now we're trying something else. Now, since we could not destabilize Cuba, and the Cubans, after 50 years here, said, no, this is not going to happen. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed in the scenario. This idea is still about with the Cuban opening. It's still about regime change. But more and more important than anything else, the Cuban has always said, like all these countries have said, that
everything is on the table to talk about except our sovereignty. The question of sovereignty, the question of a nation defining who it wants to be, what it wants to be, in the end, their own interests, and the interests often of humanity. Their interest is the interest of humanity, of working people, of poor people, indigenous people. The first thing the Venezuelan 1999 Constitution did was look out for the rights of indigenous people. Look out for the rights of women written into the Constitution. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with having free medical care? What's wrong with eliminating illiteracy in your country? That's what the Venezuelan and the revolution and the Bolivarian revolution has meant. So what do? We have to stand here, right here, and be vigilant about here. We have to call a spade a spade. We have to call who they are, right here, who are the main allies of the U.S. government, right here, CNN, the main allies of the destruction and the attempt to destabilize the Bolivarian revolution, the people's revolution, the people's revolution. We have much work to do, but that work can not just take place on Sunday the 5th, or the sixth of December. Our work has to be ongoing work. We have to begin to talk about how do we now, in our own imagination, imagine the ways, how do we now take this moment and use this moment as not only a catalyst for Venezuela, because we've seen what's happening in Argentina, but also a catalyst and a way in which we organize in the service of men and women, our brothers and sisters, all over Latin America, all over this region. This is the year, the decade, that the United Nations has designated as the year of the decade of the Afro descendant. We have to use this to talk about not only our issues here, vis-a-vis the Afro descendants, but we have to talk about that in terms of Afro descendants around this region and around the world. And we have to talk about it not from the standpoint of the needs of just Afro descendants, but the needs of humanity itself. Because the fight for the rights of Afro descendants, the fight for the effective rights, the changes in the lives of Afro descendants, means that we're fighting for the rights of all those men and women who exist and live in poverty. It's shameful when poverty, who live in poverty and war, wherever they are. This country, this region has because of Alba, because of CARICOM, and because of the Bolivarian Revolution, because of the election everywhere, this region has become a region of peace. Where is there a region of peace in the world? There's a region of peace in Latin America, and it's happened because progressive governments have taken a stand. Men and women have stood up for their right as citizens, real citizens, and transformed the whole meaning of citizenship because they've been able to stand up here. That's what's happening. And that's what happened. And we have to remember that and realize that we are their allies. We are part of this process. We're as much a part of this process here as anywhere. Here in Los Angeles, here in this nation, here in the world. I know that we're beginning here, and I know that we have a fight, but I tell you what, I've watched men and women celebrate their victory. I've looked in the faces of men and women and children whose life have been transformed by what themselves, because that transformation has come in their heart. That transformation is a transformation of love. That transformation is a transformation that cannot be overturned, cannot be stopped, and regime change is not going to change that situation. We may have a slight defeat tomorrow. We might, but we might become even more victorious. But the fact that we know that when the Venezuelan people win, we win here. When the Venezuelan people win, yes, we win here. We win here. We win here. Thank you.
This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio, and WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, also in Columbus. I'm Evan Davis, bidding you a productive week, and I'll see you again next week for another edition. Take care.